Thank you for listening to Lawford, the podcast about the village of Lawford in northeast Essex and the surrounding area. Lawford, the podcast, is brought to you by Lawford Parish Council with the aim to share what the council is up to and to highlight some of the amazing people, events and facilities in our area. Okay, so today we are delighted to chat with Ginny Hudson. Ginny and her husband Richard have built the amazing Lawford House Pool, which is a private swimming pool for hire in the village. The pool is specifically designed to be accessible for those with limited mobility. In today's episode, we're going to talk about the pool and what inspired its development, but we're also going to explore some of Ginny's other passions, which have seen her working professionally at the Cannes Film Festival, riding horses over ridiculously large fences, and lots of other interesting things that I have no idea, but we'll discover in the next 20 minutes or so. So, welcome, Ginny.
Hello.
And we should mention that Richard is sitting in as well, and we'll get Richard to chat to us on a few things a bit later as well. Morning, Richard.
Morning. Hi.
So, Ginny, just give us a bit of context in terms of, and we had a quick chat off air, and you mentioned you were born in Kenya, have lived in various places, but just give us a little bit of the kind of, your journey from Kenya to Lawford, and maybe the kind of, it feels like an interview question, but the kind of summary.
My father was in the Kenya police, so I was, my mother went out to travel and met my father. I was born out there. And then he was involved in Nama being with the police. So as soon as they got their independence, we were politely asked to leave.
Wow.
And it was all very civilised. So we left. My father took up law, became a barrister at the age of 40, which was quite a feat. And we moved to my grandparents, who were in, my step-grandfather was a trainer, horse trainer in Northamptonshire. So we spent a lot of time in Northamptonshire looking for somewhere to live. And ended up in Boxted.
Okay, so up the road from here.
Up the road from here, yeah. So loved it. Loved living in Boxted, which was then mainly farmed, but it was a fruit farm. We were surrounded by fruit trees and fruit farms. It was Carter and Blewett. And he was a very sort of forward-thinking fruit farmer. So we had this rather idyllic childhood riding through, you know, the orchards and scrumping for apples and cherries and things.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So that was good.
And do you have memories of Kenya? Just educate me, because I don't even, the Mau Mau revolution, I don't even know.
The Mau Mau was, a revolution led by Kenyatta. It was quite a violent uprising led by Kenyatta. So I think everyone had presumed when Kenyatta took power that it would continue to go downhill and be violent. But actually Kenya remained stable for many years until Kenyatta. I mean, it's still relatively stable compared to other places. My cousins are still there, but my cousin's husband was murdered 6 years ago.
Oh, my Lord.
So it's not, you know, there are still elements of violence and instability. So it's not, so I'm very relieved we came back.
Yeah.
To England.
Yeah, Boxted feels quite a long way away from Kenya. Yeah. Indeed. And was it out in, I don't know, was it out kind of safari land, or was it Nairobi?
Well, I was born just outside Nairobi. And then I think we spent a lot of time in Karen. My father was out in the bush quite a lot, obviously, because it's not, you went on patrol. I think he loved it. He had a very hedonistic life out there, you know. So it was a lovely life, and my mother and father loved it. But then when the troubles came, obviously it was tough.
Okay. Oh, that's amazing. And so it gets you to Boxted, and somewhere along the journey, piecing pieces of information together, but somewhere along the journey, you end up working in the film industry. And it sounds very exotic. You're off in Cannes Film Festival organizing events. I have no idea. Help me out in terms of what you were doing in the film industry.
I just sort of rather stumbled into it. So I was at a party one night, and I was at that time married to a local farmer, Tim Cooper, and was doing a lot of catering to keep my horses going and things. And I
couldn't live the life you wanted to live.
Yeah, exactly. So I couldn't spell, so being secretary was never an option. Cooking was my only sort of option, really, short of going to university and things. So he asked me to go and cook on a film set, And so then I started doing a lot of cooking on film sets and going
catering
for the actors.
Because I presume that's a big crew at these kind of things. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
huge, yeah. Huge crew.
Yeah.
So there's a, that was really good. And then
just loads of questions, but logistically, do you have to get all the stuff to a site? And
it's like a big circus. I mean, it's a huge because you have to have catering buses, catering tents, makeup. Winnebagos for the actors and things, and everybody. So it's probably a crew of about 80 would be a very small crew. 200 would be average.
And they're 3 meals a day, and you're trying to organise that. Oh wow!
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was a big thing. It was tough. Tough work.
And did you hang out with any of the people with name recognition or?
Yeah, I mean, because when you're on location, you are sort of like a big. It depends on the actor completely. Yeah. But some actors were very up for.
Having a chat.
We did this wonderful film in Ireland called Hanging Gale, and we were in Donegal, and it was a TV series. I think it was 4-part, and it was the McGann brothers.
Wild up in Donegal.
It was the best time. I was just going through a divorce, and I went to Donegal and had the best.
It's the wildest of the wild in Ireland, I think. Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, and it's a tough thing because, you're trying to get tea urns up a mountain and in all weathers and things like that. So it's far from glamorous.
Yeah. And so then, and that did take you to some of those big international film festivals ultimately.
Then I became a location manager. So then I started scouting and doing a little research for film. Then a friend of mine, so I was doing that, and a friend of mine set up the London Film Commission because London had become very fragmented because of the disbanding of the GEC, Greater London Council, GLC, sorry.
Okay.
Greater London Council. London became very fragmented. You had 33 boroughs, none of them working together. So it needed coordinating. So a friend of mine who was a film producer, Christabel Albury, she put together a group of us and we got London talking and got London to be more film friendly.
Properly film-friendly. I mean, it's had some run for the last 20 years.
She was the forerunner of doing this. So she got the councils to talk to her. And then we were like the sounding board for the councils and location managers to try and coordinate filming. And it was hugely successful. And it's gone on and it still continues to be successful.
Got it. And it sounds exciting, scouting, like actually finding, so is that finding like dramatic landscapes and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Or even anything. Old buildings or whatever? It could be anything, presumably.
It could be anything. Yeah. It could be, could you find me a public loo? Could you find me a moonscape? Could you find me, I want to, we need to.
And how did you do that? Was this before internet? Because like, now it seems a bit kind of relatively easy,
You have great. You have location managers, location libraries, and you do your sort of geography a bit. You think, okay, so I did a little scouting in Cornwall for unusual landscapes because you've got those lovely, wonderful sort of rock formations and things. There are some French. We've got a lot of French influence. We've got some French chateaus. We've got Waddesdon Manor, and there was an RAF base, and they were ex Rothschild. Houses, so they're sort of chateaus in the middle of the English countryside.
When did the film career come to an end? Was it motivated by your accident, or was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, okay, it was, okay, it was okay. Yeah. So I'd gone on, and I did. I was based at Pinewood for quite a long time, and so I sort of carried on doing bits, and then obviously had my accident, and that sort of
tapered off. Okay, so we're going to pivot back to a bit because one of the other passions, and I'm driving all my questions based on a bit of internet sleuthing. But you obviously had a passion for horses. It would kind of, you mentioned, I think off air that you were, you say in your Boxted years, there was the opportunity to ride horses and you had some family connections as well. Mm. So how strong was the passion? How far did you take it in terms of, I've seen you mention you were riding over some, Melton Hunt and riding over some ridiculous fences, but just give us a bit of context in terms of what that.
Brought up with ponies, much like your girls, my mum was a very passionate rider. So I brought up ponies, which was a lovely way to grow up, because you're always busy. You've always got things to do. Ponies always let you down.
It's a lifestyle, not a hobby, isn't it?
No, exactly. Yeah, and they always let you down. So they you learn humility at a very young age. but then when I got married to Tim Cooper, I when whenever I was a bit sort of didn't know quite what I was going to do next. I used to go back to the Elms, which is where my grandparents were, and some great friends of theirs were there, and they had a stud. So I used to go back there and just work with horses and things. And I bought a couple of horses from him, got them back to Tim's. And that's when I started producing young horses. So because on the farm, you can put them in a field and it didn't cost a lot of money.
But what does producing even mean? That means just...
Well, so I buy a young horse and then I break it. And then my passion, obviously, was three-day eventing. So you train it and see what skills it had. And I was very, very lucky. I had a run of very good young horses, which I sold very well. So my first horse, it was a... I remember buying it from Richard, and he used to call him the boss. And he said, well, so what are you going to do with this? And I said, well, it's going to be an eventer. And he said, oh, yeah, okay. So off I went, and I've got to prove him right. So I entered the Burley Young Event Horse.
Yeah, I was thinking Burley is the kind of the name recognition. Yeah, yeah.
So I entered the Burley Young Event Horse. So, and it was so funny. And then the horse got a virus, and so we couldn't do anything all summer. So I took her to a show, and she was just a magic horse. I mean, she was just amazing. So Burley was our second show ever, and there were flowers, and she was amazing. We were second.
Wow.
Yeah, so we were second, and we led all the way. And we were second, and we led all day, but then we got beaten by the third last person to go. So I saw that started the ball rolling for just having some... But I could never afford to go proper eventing, but I could afford to produce them. And I had lots of fun doing that.
Wow.
And
okay.
Just sort of,
and they would go on to be sold and to perform at Burley and the other 3-day eventing.
Yeah, well, because so she went off. She went show jumping about. So the Whitakers.
Oh, okay. Came, yeah, yeah. Obviously, huge name recognition. Yeah.
So they bought her, and she was a very good show jumper. She was a very good event, event or two. But her half sister I bought, and I sold her to a chap called Nigel Taylor. She was great. She was a fantastic horse. So it was always the tradition when you're schooling a young horse that you take a pool going in. No, you don't take a pool going into water because they just back off water. This horse just never backed off anything.
Okay.
And she just used to go for it. And it was just, so I sold her to a chap called Nigel Taylor, and she won lots of stuff. She won Punchestown, but then broke down in the next Punchestown.
Oh, wow.
So she won a lot of top class things. But they bred from her in the end because she was cracking there. Then I had a great horse that I bought from Lincolnshire. I had some more in between, but he was fantastic. I fell off him every day for 3 weeks. He was just the sort of horse that said, right, I've done enough now, and he'd just dump me anywhere and come home.
Wow.
And we eventually got the better of him, and he ended up being third at Burley.
Okay, so these are properly elite animals, yeah.
But you don't know that.
Yeah, but I guess that's a question. Like, how do you go and, you know, you're buying to produce with the aim to sell on.
Yeah.
But like, how do you have so much success? Because you've obviously picked up the right horses on multiple occasions. So
just like, well, I mean, it is like, but you look. I mean, you look and you see you like a horse. You get a feel for a horse. And I sort of did well with quirky horses. I don't know why particularly, but I think I had a bit more patience. And just did things. Yeah. I did much more hands-on than training. With him, I knew he was good. He had a hell of a jump. So if we could just get on top of the character and keep him interested and not tell him what to do, it was ask him what to do.
I said my wife and daughters are very passionate about it as well, but there is an awful lot about the relationship between the horse and the human and the dynamic, isn't there?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay, so that's incredible. So then life obviously changed in 2015 thanks to a pesky pheasant is kind of what I've understood, right? So do you want to tell listeners what happened and what the impact has been in terms of your life since then?
Yeah, no, because that morning I'd gone, so I had my morning, my day was mapped out. I was going to go swimming because I was going to enter the Tattingston open water thing. So a friend's got a pool up at Levington, so I did my swimming that morning. Then I went to ride the horse. I hadn't washed my hair or anything. Went to ride the horse. I thought, I'd just give him a quick run around. Da, da, da. Did that pheasant went up, and that was the end of that. I just fell and thought, it wasn't a bad fall.
So pheasant goes up, you come off this horse.
He got into a bronc and completely
buck,
went across the field bucking. And I just So I just bailed out really because I thought I'm not going to survive this.
Yeah, yeah. And as you say, you're slightly accustomed to coming off these horses, it wasn't. But on this occasion, you come off and you're not. Do you want to take it in your own words rather than mine?
Well, actually, it's quite. Yeah, I mean, nothing. So I couldn't move my legs. And I thought, okay, but don't move. His body's gone into shock. I thought my body's just gone into shock. Whatever. So luckily, the friend I'd stopped to chat to saw it happening. So she came over, they called the ambulance, an air ambulance came. I don't know how long I was there for particularly, but nothing really hurt, but it was just a bit weird. And then you just, lots of voices, lots of, my name's Ruth, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. So there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah,
and
just the medical professionals
kicking in. Just medical things, and you get to hospital. And then, it was just a bit of a blur really. I think they just pumped me full of
drugs for a bit.
Drugs and things. And I think one doctor, I think he said, oh, you've severed your spine, you'll never walk again. And I thought, that's a bit brutal.
Brutal.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess really there's no good way to tell that.
Yeah,
I know,
they're funny doctors, they really are. But so I didn't really believe him. I thought, he's just made a mistake, it's fine. In fact, he had made a mistake, it wasn't severed, it was crushed.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay, so there is a distinction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you I think you've done, you did lots of other things. You were properly injured, obviously.
Yeah,
a crushed spine and paralysis is a proper injury, but you did lots of other things as well, I think. Did you?
I've never broken a bone up until that day, and then that day I broke my neck, I broke my back in three places, broke my collar, I broke my shoulder, and broke three ribs.
Oh my lord. Okay.
So I'm made up for a lifetime of
skating on through.
Yeah.
And a slightly odd question, but like we all kind of go through life imagining, you know, kind of what if scenarios, and you know, I guess there's the what if, you know, what if I won the lottery, or what if I had a life changing accident. Did you ever have that kind of thought beforehand, and then reflecting on how you responded to the accident afterwards? Is there
I thought I'd be better off dead rather than walking, you know. I thought that was always my thing. But I never really thought it would ever happen.
Nobody thinks it. Yeah.
And then when it did happen, you think, actually, it's a lot worse than you think it is. You know, everyone was, oh, bad, like you're in a wheelchair. And actually, the ramifications are so huge.
Every aspect of your life.
Every aspect. So, you know, it's just, it's mammoth. I'm really lucky because we were married a month before my accident. But Rich has been, he's so supportive. And I'm so lucky that, A, we can afford, because you come out of rehab, you know, you're in intensive care for however long, I can't remember, but you have a person at the end of your bed 24/7.
Yeah.
Looking
and you,
after you.
You did Stoke Mandeville and all those kind of places that are associated with paralysis and injuries of that sort. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I did, but then as you get better, the care gets less. And then when you leave, you get 6 sessions of physio and that's it.
That does seem remarkable.
So they'll give you any amount of pills. They'll give you the expensive painkillers, and they'll never question that. But they won't give you any exercise. So we're really lucky because I can afford to do things.
Yeah.
Because my revenue, my income stopped completely because I was freelance.
Of course, if you're self-employed.
It's just for those in a similar position without a husband.
Who's got means, it becomes impossible.
Yeah, a nightmare. So we did the swim. Did you see it? It's quite funny. We did swam the channel in the pool.
Oh, no. I've seen most of the stuff on your internet, on your website.
I don't think I've put that on yet. I'm a bit behind on my website.
Okay.
No, so there's a very good charity. We did a swim in the pool when in lockdown because there was this thing about all the marathons not being run and charities really suffering.
Yes.
So I did, you had to do 22 or something. So I did 22 lengths for spinal injuries, 22 lengths for a charity called the Root Pride Trust, and 22 lengths for air ambulance. And we raised quite a lot of money for that, so that was good. So then Aspire, who are a very good charity, who look after people after their accident, for their home, housing, and all the sort of aspects, because you can't get into your house. Then...
Yeah, of course, it has to be you need wheelchair access or whatever else. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my house in Nisley, you know, it's on 4 floors.
Okay.
So anyway, so they put out a challenge to swim the channel over 6 weeks in whatever pool you can. So we swam the channel
wow.
in the pool.
That is quite an achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, 22 miles. So 120 lengths is a mile.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. That is a lot.
There's a lot of lengths.
God almighty. Yeah, yeah. And all, you know, propelled by the arms. Yeah, that is even more impressive. So we've kind of alluded to we opened with Lawford House Pool and obviously we've kind of talked to the motivation in terms of, but do you want to give a bit more color in terms of you obviously had a bad accident, you've come out, the aftercare is limited, and you think, right, we're going to do something about this and try and
swimming obviously is a big thing for when you're disabled, because it's non-weight bearing, it takes the pressure off every element. So, but there was no pool. We tried the David Lloyd Centre, we tried a couple of local pools, and they were cold, access into them was really difficult, and also just that amount of people seeing you when you were a strong swimmer and then you're floundering around trying to cope with, you know, the water.
Yeah, of course.
It was
yeah.
really embarrassing. So Richard came up with the idea, so a couple of our friends have got pools that they rent out, and it pays for itself. So we thought, well, we can do that and make it an accessible pool. So we did. So Richard, bless him, he'd taken a year off anyway to get this house going. So we built the pool. And it's just very simple. But you know, you've swum it.
I've swum in it. Yeah. We should allude to the fact Richard's drifted off, because this house is like Piccadilly Circus. There's people coming and going, which is lovely. Richard is a builder by trade, but he does build stunning buildings, and this building is one of them. Right? It is it's beautiful aesthetically, but actually the facilities in there, as you say, are it's obviously useful for everybody in the community, but it's specifically useful for people with limited mobility. Do you want to just talk to the? I mean, it's got a ridiculous lift system that helps people get in and out.
Yeah, the whole point for us was that we didn't want to make it look disabled, so we wanted to make it look as nice as possible. And the pool pod Richard found, and it was actually designed for the British Olympics. And it's just a platform that lowers you, that you get into a dedicated chair into the back of the pool pod, and then the platform goes over the water and lowers you into the water. So it's a very dignified way of getting in. Because I was always struck in rehab, you put in a sling and you're slung, you know, you're swung over the pool.
And it's a plava, right, as opposed to...
It's very undignified, you know, it's very undignified. So
I guess it's a life-changing event enough.
Right? Yeah.
Like without adding to it every time you do every little thing, it's God almighty, I don't need to be reminded that I've got limited mobility. And you would just talk about the because I was on your website, there might be some openings, but it's pretty much solidly booked out, which is amazing. But do you want to talk about, is it like, who's using the pool? What's the mix of people? Like, I know we used it as a family, and you know, as any ordinary pool. But then you presume you have people who have needs that are coming along as well and using it.
Yeah, I mean, there's real. I was quite surprised at the diversity of people that are using it. So we get families are coming, teaching their children to swim, and I think children in these big public pools get very intimidated. So I think this gives them a peaceful environment to properly learn how to swim.
Yeah.
So we get a lot of that. We get disabled children who then are on a level playing field with their siblings in a pool.
Which is lovely.
Really nice. We get a lot of the older generation who had knee replacements, hip replacements, whatever. We've got some group of lovely ladies who just walk up and down and gossip.
Okay, that's part of life, and it should be celebrated as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. So there's that. Quite a lot of autistic children who can't cope with the noise.
The sensory, it's more peaceful. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and just, yeah, a real mixture of people, and obviously a lot of wheelchair users. Yeah.
So you chuff with it as a kind of like, it's quite an investment. And then you want to pay for itself a little bit, but equally you want it to actually just be used, right? Presumably if you've gone the effort and gone to that. Yeah. So
It is. And it is used, and I think it is appreciated, which is great. And we need to cover its costs. They're expensive things to run. And I think also we don't get as many physios as I thought we would, but I think they're plagued by the whole health and safety
considerations.
Issue. Yeah. And the expense, because often if you have somebody in the water who's very vulnerable, you have to have someone on the outside, which just makes it also expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
So we try and do sort of discounts and things.
Do the NHS or anybody come on you? Because I know that this is your frustration about the, not frustration, I mean, it's too strong a word, but like, well, maybe it is, maybe it's not strong enough a word, but like in terms of the aftercare for who's supporting, you know, people with limited mobility, who's, you know, are they having to self-fund every time they use a facility like this?
Yeah. And then, you know, there are charities, and there's like the charity that's called Root Pry, and she had a dreadful accident. And they raise money to give people bursaries to do exercise.
Yep.
So there are private charities that do spinal injuries. They'll access the Spinal Injuries Association. They'll access these sort of funds and bursaries and things. So there is help out there, but you have to go and find it.
Yeah.
It doesn't come and find you.
And do you think all the exercise, because I know you've got another podcast with it, where they covered your exoskeleton, and that was, that seemed like your crazy next generation stuff, but do you find it, like, does it make a difference to your sense of wellness in terms of actually I feel physically stronger? And
Definitely, and I mean, just giving your organs a stretch, giving your body a stretch, it's unbelievably beneficial to get it. There aren't enough exoskeletons, but, and the reason I did that podcast was to try and publicize the exoskeleton, get more of them out and about, and this, it's slowly happening.
Yeah.
But they're very expensive, it's kits, but there's a Spanish company trying to produce one for about half the price now, and that's, so they are about, but you do have to go and get them. But they benefit everybody. Judy, who just turned up, she's got multiple sclerosis, and she had a session on an exoskeleton, which was funded by this surgeon, just to promote the value
of actually,
of walking correctly, getting the correct gait.
Yeah.
You know, and so we've done... So I've been using exoskeleton for four years, I think. So after the first 6 months, Louis, the guy that I do it with, he's brilliant. And he said he's not afraid to fail, which is, a lot of the physios do things by the book and they don't want to go off page in case it doesn't work. But Louis's not afraid of that. And he knew me well enough that I'm not afraid of it either. So he said, well, let's just try turning, because it's got a support mechanism and a walking mechanism. So he said, let's just turn the walking off and see what happens, and see if you can walk yourself. So we have somebody each side of me moving my legs. And then after about two or three sessions, my legs started to twig what they had to do. And now I can walk many lengths with just the support on.
That is.
So you're sort of making progress. You're doing exercise, but you're also making progress.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're sort of retraining, remapping, I don't know quite what.
Yeah.
But the frustrating thing is that we're not the first to have done it, but there's no collaboration, there's no sharing of these experiences.
So that's what you're trying to get the word out.
Yeah.
Look, I think we're gonna wrap it up. Jenny, we could talk for ages, but that is brilliant. And thank you for the time this morning. We'll leave it there.
No, brilliant.